Welcome to season four of The Culture of Kindness. My name is Nahala Summers and I am your host. A culture of kindness is based on the idea that by bringing kindness into leadership, we reduce stress, anxiety, make happier workplaces, and in turn, improve the bottom line for any organization or institution. It is a book, leadership program, accreditation, and of course, this wonderful podcast. Kindness has been my life's work since I founded the social movement for kindness back in 2012 called Sunshine People. And it has kept me interested on what people have to say on the complexities of kindness ever since. The guest lineup is exceptional, from politicians to social media influencers, best-selling authors to BBC presenters, an eclectic mix of people who all have completely different views on kindness, how we get it, and where the world is currently at. If you enjoy this episode, then please do show your support for kindness by subscribing to the podcast, leave a five-star review, or simply invest in the book, aptly named A Culture of Kindness, available on Amazon. Thanks so much. I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much, Johnny, for being on A Culture of Kindness. You are so welcome. I actually share your story within a lot of my talks because it is it's kind of the epitome of everything that I work towards with regards to kindness and power that a stranger can have on somebody's life. For those people who've been living under a rock and don't know your story, maybe you could just share a little bit about your story and how you've gone into the work that you have and all that great stuff.
No, thank you. Thank you for what you said. Yeah, well, I guess I suppose my story starts when I was much younger. So I'm 34 now, and I guess for me, I grew up with mental health issues. But you know, back then it wasn't really spoken about like it is now, and I really struggled particularly in my teens. I found it really difficult. I just didn't understand what was going on in my head. Particularly with, you know, I had really severe depression and I just thought I was the only one, and I was really embarrassed and scared as well, you know. And I was struggling with my sexuality. That's a whole other issue. I come from a Jewish community. That was really tough. So there was a lot going on, and essentially it culminated in me becoming really unwell when I was 20. And being admitted to a psychiatric hospital and being given this diagnosis of something called schizoaffective disorder, which is kind of like a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar. And that was it for me when I got that diagnosis. I didn't see a future. I felt like I was now a burden on, you know, the people around me. It was really tough being in that hospital. I gave up. And so I actually ended up running away from the hospital a month into my stay. I ran away and I ended up on the edge of a bridge. There was no future. I didn't see any way forwards really. Fortunately for me, you know, a stranger was walking past at that time and stopped to talk to me. And, there was just something about this stranger, and the way that he was with me. He was just so, it was just so different to all the interactions that I'd had in the hospital. In the hospital, I was on what they called the suicide ward, which is basically someone just sits and just watches you all the time. But this was different with this stranger. He wanted to talk, and he wanted me to talk, and he wanted me to, open up. And he was just so, kind and patient and gentle. And I started to, I had a connection with him and I started to open up. I just felt safe and comfortable and there was no judgment there at all. He was just really, he listened in a way that, I hadn't been listened to before. And I think that was, I needed that. I needed someone to, just hold the space and really listen and offer reassurance. And he did. He was just so like positive about my future. He kept on saying, you'll be all right, mate. You'll get better. And that, that interaction was extremely powerful. And eventually I came off the edge of the bridge and the police were waiting. So the police kind of took me away pretty quickly. And that was the interaction of me and the stranger. That was it. It had a profound impact on me because I was sectioned after that. And then I was taken back to the hospital that I ran away from. But I did feel something had kind of shifted. I mean, there was still a lot of difficult stuff in my head, but I felt something had kind of unlocked in me. And I guess it was from that stranger's kindness and his compassion and his words of hope and positivity. And I suppose that was the very, very, very beginning of like a long sort of journey to where I am today, really. To actually dealing with my mental health and not pushing it away and talking about it and learning tools to help sort of manage it.
I mean, your story is incredible. I do a talk about the power of 10 minutes, that power of kind of how you can make that change. I mean, that guy, mine is a very different story, but there is this, I think people don't necessarily understand how impactful that they can be positively or negatively in such a short amount of time, right?
100%. Absolutely. I mean, even, for me, I know, I grew up in London, I live in London, and it can be a really challenging place, particularly if you, I think, are going through a difficult time. I've been on the tube, the underground, and, I've been crying and people have literally moved away from me or, it can be really hard to find some kindness and compassion at times in London. But when it happens, like when a stranger smiles at me on the street, it's just so wonderful. It has a ripple effect. I then feel uplifted and maybe I'll smile at the next person that I see. But unfortunately, it's quite rare to find that, I think, in a place like London sometimes.
Why do you think, that the research does say that cities and are just renownedly less kind than, country towns? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a lot of kind of fear living in a city, particularly like London. I really did notice things change, I think, because, as I sort of grew up in London, I noticed things change after, the terrorist attack, on the tube and obviously the bus as well. And, the kind of the fear that was created, I think, as a result. And then, I think definitely, I've seen it myself in the last, not that I've used the tube much, but I did go on the tube in the last few months and it was so interesting watching people because they're even more sort of fearful now because of the virus. I saw people quickly moving away from someone else that was standing near them. I do worry that, I understand that, we need to keep our distance, but I think that will just create more separation from from each other. It can be such a lonely isolate, even though London is millions and millions of people. It can be so, cold and isolating because I think of this fear that so many people have. I mean, if you look at someone on the tube, I know that I'm not the only one that's said this, but there's a sense of, oh my gosh, I've just caught eye contact with that person and oh my gosh, I need to look away. And it's so funny because when I catch the last tube of the day, like at night, and people maybe have had a drink, and it's so different. Like, people will actually look at you and talk to you because they've had a drink. They let their guard down. It's so interesting. You have a chat with someone on the tube. It's so rare and nice to have a chat with someone, sitting opposite you. But unfortunately, it only often happens when there's alcohol involved, because we let down that guard and that fear and that. But yeah, it's a shame, I think,
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I agree, from the research that I've done, it just appears to me that fear is the underlying cause as to why we're not kind. And that fear comes in loads of different ways. Vulnerability, we're fearful of being vulnerable and what people might think of us. So smiling at somebody and how we feel inside of ourselves, that has an impact on how are we going to behave to somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. How do we make that change, though? I mean, it is a fascinating side, really. I mean, we have the power so easily. People will often say to me about kindness, and it's very simple, but it's not. It's hugely complex, actually, mm-hmm. and has so many different facets to it. But it is so powerful. And how do we continue to step over the boundaries of fear that stop us from doing it and move into a place where we're going to be more connected? You talk about COVID there, and I just think we're losing the chance to be connected more, right? And there's got to be ways that we can remain connected. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be so interesting coming out of this whole period, isn't it? And seeing what happens next, I think. I do worry. I think, especially, we all got used to Zoom and being online, and it's going to be so. I live alone, and I already find it strange when I go out and see people and almost sort of have to relearn how to connect with people, because I've now been on my own for such a long time. It's very strange. I think we need to definitely I think, again, going back to kindness, I think we need to be really kind, because it's not going to be so easy for people. Some people coming out of this, some people I know are raring to go back to maybe the office or some sort of normality, but some people are actually very anxious about going out there and sort of getting back. So I think that kindness is going to be really key. I've already had conversations with people who can be quite judgmental over someone else that maybe is a bit more anxious, and I try and say to them, well, put yourself in their shoes, they've suffered some sort of maybe they've had COVID themselves during this time, and they're anxious to go back out, and I'm always saying, put yourself in that person's shoes, and try a little more kindness. I think it needs to come from our sort of leadership, but I don't think it will happen. I can imagine our leadership just trying to get us all back out as soon as possible and not considering the sort of psychological impact of all of this. I think also from I know some sort of business leaders, businesses that have really tried to adapt to the current climate and tried to be extra kind of kind and generous with their staff. So for example, I know that some companies, for example, because Zoom can be, it can be quite challenging just going from one Zoom meeting to the other. Yeah. So I know some companies that will actually now start a meeting not on Zoom, but they encourage someone to go for a walk and actually talk to their colleagues while they're on their walk.
Yeah.
It can be harder face-to-face to talk and be open and be vulnerable. But if they're going for a walk, if they've just got their headphones in, just doing the audio, maybe they can be a bit more open and vulnerable and honest about how they're doing. So, which I really like, you know, because, it's not so easy for everyone just to be, you know, I'm looking at myself now on Zoom and it's pretty sort of distracting and I don't know, it's very unnatural. I like the fact, and I know some companies, for example, they're starting meetings with a 10-minute meditation or mindfulness exercise. Yeah. They launch into their Zoom meeting. I really like, you know, things like that. I just wish that all companies, organizations would kind of
adopt it. I mean, you probably already were, but from my research, I mean, you've kind of touched on all of them in your conversation, really, the core values that I talk about within kindness. And that's kind of gratitude and empathy and time and trust and connection and courage and, you know, all these great values that actually umbrella under kindness. But one of the things you also have talked about a couple of times is about judgment. You know, the idea of removing judgment and how much has that come into your work and drives your work?
Oh my gosh, it's such a massive part of it. I think, again, because of my, you know, personal experience growing up in a, as I said, a Jewish community, going to a Jewish school. There's a lot of, you know, you have to fit in certain boxes. No, and if you don't fit in those boxes, which I didn't, there is a lot of, judgment. And so, you know, my work is, I do lots of work in different areas, but a lot of work within the Jewish community now, talking about the judgment and the shame and, you know, my mental health issues that kind of came out of that. And I particularly like going into the Jewish schools and just being very open and honest and vulnerable. And I think I always get young people come up to me afterwards and, you know, they often pour out what's going on for them in their heads. And, it's interesting. I do think that, you know, things have got better since I was at school. For example, you know, when I was at school, you know, there was nothing like, no sort of awareness around, you know, LGBT+. Kind of community, but now they do, you know, they mark Pride, for example, which is great. So, you know, I do feel that and people, you know, when I go back to schools now, you know, people are very, like, young people are so open sometimes, and they say, you know, I'm non-binary, or I'm transgender, or I want to transition, and which I think is amazing. They can be so open, and I feel like, not in all cases in schools or in the community, I do feel like some areas, you know, that judgment, that shame is definitely not like it was when I was growing up, which is a good thing. But we still got a way to go. Still got a way to go. Particularly, I think, for, as I said, you know, I work in the community, but the, like, real Orthodox, the most religious sort of groups, it's so hard to kind of get through to them. You know, they've got kind of, and it's not just for the Jewish religion. I know it's true for, well, all religions, trying to reach that most, the most religious, it's so hard to reach. They're so kind of sort of insulated, and there is so much judgment within those, you know, most Orthodox religious communities. So much judgment. I hear it all the time, and that's something that I need to work on. Sure.
It's so deep rooted, isn't it? It's that kind of years and years of historical, you live and breathe by these rules, and adapting that into the new society that we live in is very hard, isn't it, for them, really?
For sure.
So tell us a little bit about the work and the work that you kind of do, and how this kind of journey of the stranger on the bridge and how that kind of evolved into what you do now. I'd love to hear about that.
Well, I think essentially, you know, I guess things sort of, I guess I came into this work that I do now probably about 7-8 years ago, when I was in a better place myself. And I actually decided to find that guy on the bridge. I decided to search for him because, you know, obviously wanted to thank him for what he'd done, obviously. But I wanted to raise awareness as well of, you know, mental health issues and also suicide as well. It's a difficult one, but I need to talk about it. So we launched this search to find him, this guy. And it was amazing. The response was huge, and we had so many people come forward saying, I've also stopped someone in a similar position. It was just, it was just really, really quite moving hearing all these stories of people that had intervened. And then fortunately for me, the guy that I was looking for came forward. And that was, to be reunited. And that was so special, you know, being reunited and getting to say thank you. And he was so kind and humble and, didn't see it as a big deal what he'd done. And then after that, he said, well, I want to get involved in the work that you do. You know, I want to help. And so we started giving talks together in all sorts of places, you know, prisons, schools, universities, workplaces, a lot of NHS trusts, the police, just trying to, you know, just talk about our story and, you know, I guess that act of, that act of kindness and just generosity and the impact that it had. And, it's been really incredible getting to, you know, share that story and empowering others to open up and to hopefully maybe change their behaviors. You know, a lot of people afterwards say, oh, I wonder if I would have stopped someone if I saw them, and, you know, maybe I would now, which is great, which is, you know, what you want to hear. People have been impacted. We've been doing that now for, about 5 years. We've been traveling around and talking and sharing our story. And obviously it's different now because of COVID, you know, everything's online. It's not the same as, you know, being in person, but you just have to do what you can, you know, online. You just have to do what you can. And the message still, I think the story is still as powerful online, you know.
Yeah.
The message that we're trying to get out is still, it's still there online. Just not the same as in person. You know, what can you do?
Yeah, that's right. So you've started doing the talks, but you're actually doing some stuff in schools as well, I think. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's my big focus, to be honest, is schools, young people. His name's Neil. He's not a stranger, obviously. Me and Neil. His name's Neil.
He was a stranger, but he's a friend now.
Now he's Neil. So we set up a charity, a youth mental health charity, just over 2 years ago called Beyond. And that's all about trying to, you know, get in early when it comes to mental health, the preventative end of mental health. We focus on the crisis point so much, but, you know, we want to take it back to the preventative or the early intervention stage. So we just created a mental health festival for schools and colleges, which happened in early February, and that was great. So many schools and colleges got on board, so many young people, teachers as well. You know, teachers are really struggling at the moment, and parents that are, or carers that are having to homeschool. There's a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety out there, and, you know, I just don't think we're dealing with it properly at all. So yeah, we created this festival, this online festival, virtual mental health festival, and it was great to see so many people get involved. And hopefully, it's just the start for us. You know, we want to do so much more. Schools and colleges and universities are crying out for more support. So we want to do what we can to try and get that support in there for everyone, not just for the young people.
Yeah. So schools will be able to look that up and get involved. Will you aim to do it every February? Will that be the goal?
Yeah. But we've got stuff planned throughout the year. We don't just want it to be this one day festival and then that's it. You know, we need it to, that support and that help to carry on throughout the year. Yeah. Often with mental health, it's, you know, it's World Mental Health Day, let's all mark that, and then that's it. Do you know what I mean? we often do that with awareness days and weeks and months. It's just, right, let's mark it. Okay, done. Right, let's move on. But, you know, for people living with mental health issues all the time, it carries on. So, you know, we can't just mark one day and then forget about it.
Yeah, there's this conversation of a rise in suicide among our young people that is, I find, nerve-wracking, really, and uneasy that we would have so many young people who are so unhappy and so young as well. What's your thoughts and understanding of that as you kind of work in that arena and probably much better?
It's so tragic. I hear so many stories from, you know, people left behind, siblings, parents, friends. It's just always so tragic. And often it's come out of the blue, or, you know, they didn't get the help they needed. I just think, again, there's just not enough awareness and understanding and education around suicide prevention. I do think there's, again, going back to fear, I think there's a big fear around talking about suicide. And, you know, people often say, well, if I talk about it, I'm going to put it in someone's head. But that's just a myth. It's been proven. That's just a myth. You know, if you actually talk about it, it will help someone who might be feeling suicidal to open up. And again, because going back to shame and judgment, there's a big fear of shame and judgment if people open up, you know, how they're feeling, the suicidal thoughts and feelings. So, yeah, when I'm talking to, you know, young people in particular, I'll be very open about, you know, my past experiences, particularly around suicide. And obviously, you know, if I'm talking to very young children, yeah, I don't need to go into it. But if I'm talking to, you know, teenagers, it's so important to a lot of people just, they want to avoid that topic, that subject. You know, it's still quite taboo. It's getting a bit, it's not, you know, mental health, things like depression, anxiety are much more in the public sort of awareness. People are talking about it. But certain things like suicide just still, I feel, they are quite taboo. And there's some amazing organizations that are doing great work in this area, like Papyrus. Papyrus is a suicide prevention charity, particularly aimed at young people. They have something called a Hope Line for young people, which is great. And there's a charity called Calm, which is really aimed at male suicide prevention, because the statistics, male suicides are just really, really tragic. So yeah, there's a lot of great work that's going on, but again, not enough. There's just not enough of it, you know?
What's your thoughts on why we've seen such a change in mental health? I mean, there are two sides to it, isn't it? Have we just never measured it before, for example? Or is there this kind of genuine rise in mental health challenges that we're currently seeing?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think it's a combination. I think, you know, we are talking about it more. You know, in the last few years, in the last year, actually. I mean, I hear it almost every day, maybe, on the news. It's mentioned, and like 5-10 years ago, that wasn't the case. So there's definitely more awareness and definitely more talk about it. But I do feel there has been a rise. And I think, you know, it's a difficult one. Things like social media and technology, people are very quick to blame those things. And, you know, look, for some people, social media actually helps their mental health and well-being. But, you know, for some, that's not the case. And I know quite a few people actually recently that have sort of come away from social media during the pandemic because it's just too overwhelming and just too much. And also, I think, you know, things like the way that people talk to each other on social media, you know, cyberbullying is a real issue that, again, I just don't think we're addressing. You know, for young people, bullying used to kind of just happen in school, in the playground. But now bullying can carry on 24/7 because of phones and, you know, things like, I hear it all the time. Teachers just don't know what to do with, or parents just don't know what to do. They can't take the phone away from, because, you know, that just wouldn't work. But what do you do? How do you control? Like, you know, you can't be with your child looking at their phone or that, you know, that it's really difficult. And again, I just don't think we've been given the right. I do wish that, you know, social media companies and technology companies would have a bit more. Well, they do a bit more when it comes to mental health and wellbeing. They've just given us these things, social media, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever, TikTok, and there you go, just have it. And they're not realizing the sort of psychological implications that they can have. As I said, they can be used for like good, you know. Yeah. I found the girl on the bridge through social media, you know, through Facebook. So it can be amazing, but it can also be detrimental, you know. And I do think there's a correlation between the rise in use of social media and technology and mental health issues, particularly in young people.
Yeah, there was an article that interviewed a number of people who had been part of the development of things like the like button, the refresh as you scroll, you know, all of these kind of little things, but that actually some of those people spoke about the regret that they had in the design of that, and that actually they don't let their own children use what they've designed, which I think is fascinating. You know, they didn't know what they were doing at the time. They obviously wanted to send people to it and they want people to react to it, but they didn't realize that actually the consequences for people on their mental health who were not necessarily emotionally intelligent enough or self-aware enough to be able to see, hang on a minute, I'm scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling here, I've got to stop and put my phone away and go and do something else. For those people, it's an immense struggle for them and cruel. So yeah, I think I would agree. I think social media has some amazing things. You know, I've got a kindness tribe on there and you can change your whole algorithms, right? But it's also got that other side for people who aren't able to see the power it has over their lives.
This is the thing, and you know, so I work together with a young lady called Louisa, who actually, with this mental health festival, it was her vision, the mental health festival, but she specializes in, you know, going into schools and talking to young people about social media and how to use it, kind of how to manage it, things like, you know, choosing who you follow and choosing your feed. People don't know that you can, you know, do all these things, and again, I just think there needs to be more education around it, but not just for young people, but for adults as well. They don't. No. You know, this is we didn't grow up in a world. I mean, I'm glad in a way I didn't grow up in a world where there was Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok. I'm kind of glad, actually. That sounds good.
Yeah, me too. Just good old fashioned bullying was the way that we remember it. It was I fully agree. I can't believe we've already come to the end, and I'm going to put in the details of the talk in so that people can look you up and follow more about the work and your charity and what you do. I always close on the final question, and I have never heard the same answer again, which is unbelievable after the amount of episodes I've done. But what does a culture of kindness mean to you?
Well, yeah, I think for me, you know, when I got my diagnosis at 20, I felt like an absolute outcast. And I speak to a lot of people who have a similar diagnosis or have a maybe more extreme diagnosis of like paranoid schizophrenia. I do think there's certain mental health conditions like schizophrenia and borderline personality disorder. That there's just so, it makes me very sad. You know, I just, I'm very lucky because I've managed to get, you know, insight, and I've managed to develop confidence to talk, and I have tools, you know, I use mindfulness, meditation, you know. I have something called compassion-focused therapy, which is so helpful for me, but I just speak to a lot of people that just feel, yeah, they just feel kind of lost in society, and I just wish that there was more, yeah, kindness and compassion towards these individuals who just maybe struggle a bit more every day to do things. They're, you know, things like the workplace, for example, is key. The statistic is that only 8% of people with schizophrenia are in work in the UK, which is very low. And I speak to a lot of people with schizophrenia who want to work, but there's not the understanding in the workplace. There's not the kindness in the workplace that they need. You know, I used to work at a charity called Rethink Mental Illness. And I'll never forget when I was in the office, it was an open plan office, and someone started a job there, and they were given their desk, and their desk was facing the wall. And they turned around in front of everyone and said, look, I hear voices. And, you know, if I face the wall, I won't know if they're coming from somewhere in the office or in my head. Can I just face the office? And everyone was like, the manager was like, yeah, of course, absolutely. Here's a new desk. And there was just this incredible culture of kindness and acceptance for everyone, everyone. I think pretty much everyone in the office had mental health issues. And there was just, it was amazing to be in an office. I've never worked somewhere where there was this, yeah, this kindness and compassion and openness. And it then meant that everyone in the office was just so open and honest with how they were doing. If they had a bad day, if they're having a bad day, fine. You know, we all knew what to do. We all knew the right things to say, the right support to give. And it was really special working in a place like that. And I just think I wish that all sort of workplace cultures were like that, but I know they're not just yet.
I'm working on it with a culture of kindness, but there is this lack of judgment that you talk about that is so desperately needed, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It really is. I think we'll get there.
Yeah.
You know, particularly I think with, you know, going back to what I said, the younger generation, there's so much more acceptance. I gave a talk in a boys' school probably about 2 years ago. And after I spoke, this young boy put his hand up in front of all the other boys and said, look, I've not been myself for like the last few months. And I know, you know, I might be really quiet and by myself. I've been really struggling with depression. I've been really struggling with my mental health. And he stood up, he told everyone, he sat down, and these boys just all turned around to him and clapped and like patted him on the back and were like, mate, you know, don't worry, we're here. And it was amazing to watch that, the support that was given to this young boy. And again, when I was at school, yeah, that just never would have happened. But I do feel really positive about the next generation and their level of sort of tolerance and acceptance, you know. I feel really encouraged by that.
Yeah, definitely. There is hope for the future, for sure.
Mm.
Johnny, thank you so much for your time. It's incredibly precious, and I'm going to continue to keep sharing your story within my talks as well, because I just think it's invaluable. And thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have loved this episode, please do share it with others. Pop on and give a lovely review, but mostly take forwards into your life something that can change someone else's. We are looking for the elusive happiness, and kindness is the action that can get us there.